Hey folks, this is 13 and 3, otherwise known as Mogi and JC, welcoming you to the next episode of the Breakout Sessions podcast. This episode is sponsored by Raleigh's Coach Club and Hertel Law. We would like to welcome our featured guest to the podcast, the number 5 overall pick in the 1978 NHL Amateur Draft, 6-year NHL veteran, longtime NHL GM, and current player agent, Mike Gillis. Mogi?
Wow, quite a resume, Mike. We cannot wait for this podcast here, and we're all ready for you. How are things out in Vancouver Island?
Things are great. I do have to correct you. I'm not a player agent. I am doing consulting work for the NHLPA, which is the union that represents all the players. So I'm no longer an agent, even though I did that for quite a long period of time after law school and really enjoyed it. But today I'm a consultant.
All right. Well, sorry about that.
Yeah, well, I'm anxious to hear about that as well. But, you know, we'll get right to it. You know, you were born in Sudbury, Ontario, a Canadian boy. Weren't you destined to be a hockey player, you know, based on just your geographics alone right there?
No. You know, I grew up playing every sport. My dad was a semi-pro baseball player, so I played a lot of baseball, and basketball, volleyball, lacrosse, box lacrosse, not field. And no, it wasn't destiny. I think what separates every NHL player from others is their love of the game. And when you come to love playing hockey, going to the rink, eventually you're going to excel at it as best you can, and you might reach the NHL, but everyone shares that same trait.
Well, I know that I was dreaming about being in the NHL at one time too, but that didn't happen with me. You know, when you were developing your skills, you know, skating, shooting, stick handling, what sort of things were you practicing to get those skills? Were you a kid on the outdoor rink, you know, eluding the larger, bigger players, or how did your development begin?
Well, it began with, again, loving going to the rink. I mean, we played in Toronto then, and when we were kids, there were still outdoor rinks everywhere, and we played a lot of pickup hockey, a lot of shinny hockey. I went to a high school in Toronto, which I think has produced close to 400 NHL players over time, and we had our own rink, and the rink was for our use. So we played before school, we played at breaks, we played at lunch hour, we practiced after school. So I was incredibly fortunate to have a lot of ice time available. And, you know, we grew up in a different era than today, obviously, but, you know, we just played a lot and we loved playing pickup hockey. And I think your skills, you know, because we didn't wear a lot of equipment, you had to learn how to fall properly. You need to hone your skills, particularly skating and stick handling. And it was a much more free-flowing type of atmosphere where there wasn't a tremendous amount of coaching structure. So you just played and played. And when somebody did something that was really cool or you hadn't seen before, then you would attempt to do it. And we always played with older kids as well. So We didn't grow up being intimidated or afraid playing. We watched the older guys and we did everything we could to be just like them. So we, you know, it was a pretty unique atmosphere.
So were you kind of like when you're young, the older guys accepted the young guys and brought them along, and then you guys did the same thing when you got older and brought the younger kids along as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, before I played junior hockey, I was 14. Playing on a team that was mostly 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds, and they took, you know, they were protecting us all the time. There were a couple of us, and it was a really fun time to be playing hockey because you weren't overcoached and you could you could try things and do things. And you know, I grew up playing every position on the ice except goalie, and loved it. Loved playing defense. Loved playing center. you know, and as you move up the pyramid, obviously it gets more refined and you get coached more, but it was a really fun time to be growing up and playing hockey.
Do you see it different for this generation of hockey players?
Yeah, I do. I think kids are getting pushed into playing hockey as their dominant sport at a much earlier age. You know, there's a lot of structure, a lot of coaching, a lot of early determinations about someone's ability. And like, I can tell you, when I was 8 to 10, there were lots of kids that were better than our group. And our group all made it to the NHL. None of those other guys did. Like, they stopped growing, or they stopped being interested, or they didn't love the sport as much. And we went right past them and ended up doing quite well. And I just hate the idea of kids being, pigeonholed as to what they're going to be when no one can accurately predict that. And it takes the love of the sport away from them. You know, if they're being told, like, at 10 that they're a third-line left winger, like, you know, they'll find something else to do. And I really disagree with overcoaching young kids. I think if they don't develop a love of the sport, they're not going to go anywhere, so why take that love away from them?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you were a phenomenal junior player, scored 132 points in 111 games with the Kingston Canadians of the Ontario Major Junior Hockey League. Better than a point a game. Then you had an injury and missed the majority of the 76-77 season. With that injury, do you think that set you back at all? And if you wouldn't have had that injury, do you think you would have even dominated the league more the following year?
I broke my leg really badly in that season, early in the season, and missed the entire year, which was, a pretty formative year of development. So it was, it caused me to work extremely hard in the off season to get ready for the following season. Then the following season, I broke my collarbone twice, so I missed a big chunk of that year as well, which didn't help. But, injuries are part of it. And I think that, you don't get through this without adversity. Like, there isn't an NHL player walking around who didn't suffer some form of adversity, whether it was self-imposed or injuries or imposed by others. So, it is a sport that you have to learn how to fight through problems, and you have to learn how to manage things at an early age. And, getting hurt wasn't the best thing, obviously, but I did learn that you can overcome it if you work hard enough and get prepared, and that's what I tried to do.
So, Mike, by the looks of your points with 39 goals and 93 assists, were you more of a playmaker than a scorer at that point?
Yeah, I played both defense and center at that point in my playing. And, I did consider myself as more of a vision type player, more of a playmaker than a goal scorer necessarily. But it also, I played with guys that were really good goal scorers. So, my first year of junior, I played with Ken Linsman on the same line, and we were both really young. He scored 63 goals that year. So, it just kind of, it seemed to fit. And if we wanted to win hockey games, he had to score, he had to get the puck. And I was in a position to do that. So, you learn how to adapt and you learn how to play in the circumstances. And I think that's what really good players end up doing is you maximize whatever hand you're dealt, and you deal with it and you play your best.
I think that's a great point that you just made, is the good ones recognize that and are able to adapt. I think some of the guys that don't make it don't understand that that's, they have to change their game or their style or something, and they're not willing to do that, and things don't work out well for them then.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, there's a lot of guys that were really great goal scorers that played junior in college that ended up being defensive, really strong defensive players in the NHL because they couldn't translate that level of talent into the top league in the world. So they had to adapt, and they did it very well. There's lots of examples of guys that do things a little differently when they get to the top level.
You know, you mentioned this core group of players that you grew up with, and all of them, the majority of them, if not all of them, went on to the NHL. How many guys were in that core group, you know, that you grew up with? And because of their success, is there a coach that you want to give a shout out to that really helped form you guys?
Yeah, we had a really good coach in junior B hockey at St. Mike's, the high school I went to. He was a really, really good coach and was really concerned about us developing, but enjoying the game as much as we could. We had a lot of fun, and we all ended up going in different places in major junior hockey to play. But we had a great time, and we would get together in the summers and literally go to a place that everybody in Toronto knows. It was called Double Rink Arenas, but it had 8 ice surfaces, and we just followed the Zamboni around. So the Zamboni would clean one surface, we'd go and play for half an hour, follow it to the next rink, and the next rink, and play all day. And
that's awesome.
It was just a fun time to be really enjoying playing hockey, and all these kids that I played with at Double Rink, you know, they're various ages, but we all went on and played at a really high level.
Speaking of a high level, you were drafted number 5 overall in the 1978 NHL entry draft by the Rockies. So what did you have in your game that the Rockies used such a high pick on you?
Well, I think that I was big enough to take the physical pressure of playing in the NHL, but skilled enough to produce points. I had a really good junior career, even though I got hurt a lot and played with really good players. We had 3 players off our team selected 5, 6, and 7 that year. Myself, Ken Linsman, and Ben Wilson. And then we had 2 other guys that were picked in the top 25, I think. And then guys that I played with on that team in the following years were first-round picks. So we had a really strong team in playing junior, and I think that helped all of us because we played in a really competitive environment and played with good players. So, you know, rising tide raises all ships, and we had good players, really good players.
So what were practices like with that group?
They were intense. You know, they were challenging. I went to an all boys Catholic school. So I used to walk to practice with a shirt and tie on and a sports jacket, and yeah, they couldn't understand. They thought I was the most straight-laced guy on the planet, but none of them bothered to find out that I went to a private high school, a Catholic high school. So it was pretty funny after the fact when they were told that.
They thought you were a young businessman or something?
Yeah, like, you know, I don't know what they thought. They thought I was super straight-laced and all this stuff. Didn't realize you had to wear a uniform to go to that school.
You mentioned injuries. Did that plague follow you into the NHL as well?
Yeah, I had a total knee reconstruction. I hurt my knee in my first year in training camp, and it was still when surgeries like that were really intrusive and difficult, and recovery was difficult, and I came back too early from that injury and couldn't play the way I was used to playing, and it was probably the hardest thing that I had to deal with because it was a really difficult injury to overcome. I broke my leg a couple of years before that. It was the same leg, and it just seemed like it was a long time in responding and coming back. And, you know, that's what happens, though. If you want to play hockey in the NHL, you're going to get hurt eventually. And I was just unfortunate it happened early in my career.
You know, was that kind of humbling to a certain point that, you know, you've got these injuries and then as a result, you know, as you mentioned, you're not playing the way you want to and you're either scratched or you're sent down to the AHL or one of the minor leagues?
Yeah, it's really challenging. You know, like when you're growing up and you have this natural progression if you're good enough to just continue escalating and escalating and escalating. And then, you know, you reach the toughest league in the world, the best league in the world, and any little setback can have a major impact. You know, it's if you can't keep up, or and those guys are, you know, they're tough guys. I mean, they would expose you if they could. So it was super challenging to try and fight back from that particular injury for lots of reasons. I had a couple setbacks later on, injuring the same knee again, and it was just a time frame before the operations like this were, you know, they were just super intrusive, and it isn't like today where you could do arthroscopes and do a lot of repairs without really causing more damage. So it was tough.
How are your knees now?
You know, not bad. Not bad. It's I cycle a lot. If I don't cycle a lot, then I can really notice it a lot more. So, you know, if you keep the muscles around your knee a little bit stronger, it's less, you know, less of a problem. But I know lots of guys, I mean, pretty well everyone I played with in Boston in particular left the game with really serious physical problems. And, you know, it was just a different era where the medical services weren't what they are today.
You know, you just mentioned Boston. You know, what was that like? You know, you're drafted fifth overall by a team, and then they trade you to Boston. Was that tough to swallow, or how did you feel about that?
Well, it was it was interesting because, you know, the team in Colorado was a really young team. I think we went through six coaches in 3 years. It was really disorganized and not, you know, not a great environment. We had good players, but not a good team. And then I went to Boston, which was a much older team, much more senior players. And it was just a completely different approach to how you played and the confidence you went into each game with. And you know, the guys were super tough guys who were veteran players, and it was a really different environment. So it was challenging, but it was also really enlightening. You know, I just, at that point, I just couldn't play the way I wanted to play, which was difficult. And, you know, so I had a struggle staying on that team as a regular, but it was a great experience.
I can only imagine. We're going to take a break here for 1 second to give a shout-out to one of our sponsors, Raleigh's Coach Club in Altoona, Wisconsin, located across the street from the Altoona Ice Center on Spooner Avenue, has been a staple in the Altoona community for decades, providing support and sponsorship for youth and adult sports, which includes the men's league that Mogi and I play on. Raleigh has been always a huge supporter of hockey, and he will always have your favorite beverage ready and your favorite team on the screen when you arrive. Mog?
Absolutely. So, Mike, following your playing career, you coached at Queen's University and then earned a law degree from that same university and became a player agent. So when you were playing, did you have a good agent?
No, I did not.
So what kind of, because of that, did you have setbacks, or why do you say that? Did he not negotiate the contract you wanted, or what was the setback with the particular agent you had?
Well, he ended up going to jail. He ripped off a bunch of players and did a bunch of nefarious things. And
is this the same agent that Bobby Orr had?
Yes, same one.
Can you give a little background to this guy if you're comfortable with that?
Well, he was a lawyer who was also the head of the union, which is where I'm doing some consulting work today. And there were just a lot of, how you say it, conflicts and other things that were prevalent at the time. And, you know, it turned out that he eventually went to jail for fraud and mail fraud in the U.S., a violation of the RICO Act. And I ended up getting hurt quite badly in my last year in Boston. I broke my leg in a spiral fracture and spent about 8 months in a cast. And so we all had disability insurance. And in my particular case, he ended up defrauding us out of some of the disability money that we were entitled to. So we took him to court, won, and he eventually went to jail.
Well, man, I bet you learned some lessons by having an agent like him, kind of like what not to do as an agent.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot not to do, and having played at a high level, I had the same experience as most of the general managers. So in some cases, a lot more, and combining that with a law degree, it was a good opportunity to represent guys the way I felt that they should be represented, and made sure that my duty to them was observed at all times and avoided conflicts, and made sure the player was put first, and it worked out really well.
You know, a good friend of yours that we interviewed in a previous podcast, Peter Byrne, was a co-author of a book. And in one of his chapters, he cites, if you're a player, you do not want your agent and financial advisor to be the same person. And the incident, that you're talking about with you and Bob Yore, and I'm going to throw this guy's name out there because it's
common well knowledge.
Common knowledge, Alan Eagleson. You know, was that your situation too, that he was the combination of both for you, or was he just, just that underhanded, for lack of better terms?
No, he was acting in both roles. And again, like I mentioned, there were a lot of conflicts, and we paid the price. We were fortunate. We went and got our money back, and others weren't as fortunate as we were, for sure. And in some cases, it was really debilitating for guys. So, I absolutely learned lessons from watching that and being part of it, and was determined to never allow that to happen. And I agree completely with Peter. If you were building an app, you wouldn't go to an insurance company to build an app for you. Like, it's, the opportunity to be conflicted, to get kickbacks and do all those things is profound with young athletes. They're not sophisticated. Oftentimes they're not prepared or educated about how business should work and how people should operate, and they can easily be taken advantage of. And I think Peter is absolutely correct.
So, Mike, you went from being a player agent to the GM of the Canucks back in 2008. Did your experience as a player agent help you in your role as a GM?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I knew mostly every GM from my playing days, and being an agent, I represented really high-end players, so I had an opportunity to do really strong contracts because the players were really good, and I knew the CBA inside and out, so it was really beneficial. And being trained as a lawyer, you do have skills that you spend a lot of time academically developing. And I also practiced corporate commercial law when I came out of law school at one of the top firms in Canada. So I was really well prepared, and had the advantage of having mentors and different people that helped me along the way. And I tried to use that skill set to my players' advantage all the time. And oftentimes, just like a young hockey player isn't all that sophisticated, I would run into certain people on the team side of the equation that didn't have the same background and didn't have the same mentorship and opportunities to learn and develop legal skills, and consequently it gave me a bit of an advantage in certain circumstances.
So how thrilling was it to see the Canucks reach the Stanley Cup Finals in 2011?
It was exhausting.
Well, I enjoyed watching, just saying.
it was it was really interesting. You know, we had put together a really good team. We had great leadership on the team. We had really good coaching. And to get there, it truly is, you know, hockey, one of the things that separates hockey from some other sports is it truly requires everybody on the team contributing top to bottom, from management to coaching, to training staff, to medical staff, to the players. And we were really fortunate. We had a great group of leaders on the team that understood where we were trying to go. They adopted everything. We tried a lot of things to try and help them not just become better players, but also be fitter and stronger and be able to withstand all the travel we had to do. So we were really fortunate. We had a great group of leaders that that didn't push back. They adopted everything and they went with it. And we were lucky. We should have won the Stanley Cup that year for sure.
You know, how energetic is it to have twin brothers, or I don't know if they're twins, but
they're
at least
twins,
the Sedin brothers on the team. You know,
identical twins.
did they bring a little dynamic to that team?
Well, they were great players and great leaders. I mean, it was hard to tell them apart at times, but they were exceptional. And you know, they played a very interesting style. They had played together their entire lives, and so they had almost this intuitive sense of where they were on the ice and where they, what they were trying to do. And when they were in their prime, it was just magic to watch them. So it was a real pleasure to be part of that team with those guys on it.
So I understand that they're working with your the Abbotsford affiliate, the AHL team with Vancouver, and hopes they'll someday get elevated to a NHL GM. What do you think their chances are when they get there?
I think they're great. I mean, they're smart, very solid guys. You know, they're from a smaller town in Sweden. they've got incredible character. I can't say enough about them. They're great players, great character guys. They played the style that they had to play to be successful. They believed in it. I think they're going to do really well. I think they're exactly what a team should be looking for when it comes to management.
We're going to take another break here and shout out another one of our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored in part by Hertel Law, the law firm you want on your side. Focusing on criminal defense and personal injury, Harry Hertel has been obtaining results for clients in the Chippewa Valley since 1981. When you need legal help, if injured or accused of a crime, call 715-832-4330 for a free in-person consultation.
You know, Mike, we've talked a little bit about this GM position that you held. Obviously, you've got experience as an NHL player. You've got quite an education. What else prepared you for that position, and why did the Canucks choose you? What did you have over all the other, you know, possible candidates?
I think that, you know, I had been offered GM jobs before that and turned them down because I didn't think it was the right situation, or for personal reasons, you know, having to travel or move and do various things. It was the right time for me personally. I had had, I started in the NHL at 19, so I had a long, diverse kind of build up towards that. And, I think if you're a good agent, you know every team inside and out and how they operate and where there's good situations, where there's bad ones, who the best coaches are, who the best run organizations are. And I had the benefit of a long period of time and observing all that. And I think when they asked me to consider it, I gave them a roadmap to success. The team was a non-playoff team. And they had good players, but I had witnessed that in Colorado where we had really good players and a terrible team. This wasn't a terrible team, but it wasn't a successful team. And my roadmap was to do things differently to get the highest productivity out of the players that we had. And when we introduced new players into our culture, that we made really quick decisions as to whether they were going to fit in and do what was necessary to be the absolute best contributor. And that was the roadmap that we designed, and we were fortunate. We had really good players who were poised to get better. They adopted all of the competitive initiatives that we brought to the team. They embraced them. They all had career years over the time we were there. And we had really good coaching. So it was an opportunity for me to, I knew the team really well. And it was an opportunity to say, okay, I think if we do this, this, and this, and we, you know, we invest here and here and here, we can put something together that should be really competitive in a short period of time. We were fortunate, and that's what happened.
You know, let's talk about your playing days again, if you don't mind, in the NHL. Somebody that stands out that was your toughest competitor. Anybody that comes to mind?
No. There's a long list. A long list. I mean, the team in Boston that I played on had players like Wayne Cashman and Brad Park and John Rattel, who was one of the... I don't think John had a five-minute major penalty in 22 years in the NHL, but he was just one of the toughest, best, smartest players I had ever played with. Stan Jonathan, John Wensink. You know, there were really tough competitors on every team. You know, I don't know if you guys recall a guy named Al McAdam who played in Minnesota. Like, super tough guy, unassuming, but super tough. And there were a lot of hard-nosed, tough players back in that era. And, you know, fighting was a lot more prevalent, certainly more so than it is today. Every player was tough. You know, it was a tough league. And There were a lot of guys that you could put on a list that were really hard-nosed, tough competitors to play every night.
You know, do you think in your mind that there is a spot in hockey for fighting?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think that the history behind fighting is one that's difficult for people to get away from. I don't think it's a necessary part of the game any longer, particularly at lower levels. There shouldn't be any fighting in hockey up until it's serious and it's, you know, you have a chance for it to be a profession. And even then, I think it's gradually diminishing all the time. You know, there are certain members of the fan base that clearly like fighting and, you know, probably have never been in a fight in their lives because, you know, they don't know. But I think that it's going to naturally disappear. I think that's the right thing to happen. I think it'd be difficult to end it, you know, with one in, like, from one day to the next. I think that would be really challenging. But I do think it's disappearing, and I don't think there's going to be a place for it in the near future.
So, Mike, after you left the Canucks in 2014, you went on to teach at the University of Victoria. Did you see yourself getting out, being out of hockey, or did you hope of getting back in the game eventually?
I didn't know. You know, I had a lot of interests that I wanted to pursue, and I was getting paid by the Canucks. So I just traveled around the world and looked at different sports organizations that were successful, different leagues, different coaching techniques. And our daughter was the captain of the Canadian national field hockey team, the Olympic field hockey team. So she was playing in tournaments, and I would just travel around watching her play and go to different places like Barcelona and Australia and premiership teams in England and Africa and other places, and just try and get as much sports knowledge as I possibly could and see how people were using technology to advance player performance, using sports science, medical science to have healthier, longer lasting careers. And I just took the opportunity to really take a hard look at sport, where it was going to go. I had some teams reach out to me. I you know, through those travels, I began to understand that I thought a different organizational structure would be the most successful in an NHL setting. And I think teams were really reluctant to get to that because I didn't necessarily want to be the GM again. I thought that there was a better role for someone like me in a different capacity to almost be a senior advisor as opposed to you know, the energy you need to be a GM in the NHL. So, you know, I did do it. Now I'm working with the NHLPA as a consultant, helping them with their digital strategy involving player imagery and opportunities driven through technology. And it's been a lot of fun. So, you know, I don't need to be part of an NHL franchise to, you know, feel like my career has to continue that way. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in sport that you can contribute to, and that's my focus today.
No, that was one of my questions I was going to ask you about working with the Players Association now and whether or not you wanted to lead your own team. So it's interesting. It doesn't seem like doing the Players Association stuff is going to meet your need for competition, where running a team, you know, there's got to be that competitive fire burning inside you. How do you get that fulfilled in your life right now?
Well, it's a lot more competitive than you may think. And, you know, there's tremendous opportunity. And I was always a players first guy. When we ran the Canucks, I felt our success was because we were player first. Our orientation was player first. And trying to do everything we possibly could to keep guys healthy, treat them respectfully. And that was probably born out of my playing career, which was a radically different era. But, you know, the idea of putting people in a position where they're the most productive. And, you know, I don't necessarily view the GM role as being as competitive as some people may think. It's really a chess match where you're trying to fit pieces together and understand people's capacity and how they fit in and build culture and realizing that, you know, leadership development is every bit as important as on-ice development. It is a full-time, you know, 24/7, 365-day job, and you have to have the energy to do it. And I'm not sure if I want to do that in that capacity any longer. I think there's opportunities to create an organization that's different than the historic NHL one, but, you know, right now I'm enjoying myself with the PA and having a lot of fun and building a business for them that I think is going to be really viable in the future.
So if you don't mind, can I ask you what kind of job you think Billy Guerin's doing with the Minnesota Wild?
I think he's doing a good job. You know, he realized the need to improve goaltending. I think he had some good players there that he inherited, but you always inherit something. So, you know, it's really what you do with it. And I think he's done a good job.
You know, we've been talking about your position with the NHLPA. You know, some of our listeners probably recognize those, you know, letters right away. But for those that don't, give us the Reader's Digest version of what the NHL Players Association is.
Well, it's a labor union, first and foremost, that's there to protect player rights, collectively bargain on behalf of the membership, ensure that there's workplace safety as best as possible, ensure that there's medical standards and other standards that are adhered to all of the time. It's very much a historic union in its operation. And we're now moving it in a direction to build a business around the players' rights and their images and their ability to connect with fans in a different way that technology is really driving. So, you know, it's an interesting time frame. Technology is providing all of these tools that are available for elite level players to connect directly with fans and to build fan communities and get out from underneath the helmet and the visor and show people, you know, really what their character is like. And it's a great opportunity to build that out and see where it goes.
any desire to run the NHLPA?
Not at this time, no. I'm really content where we are, and we have some grandkids, and I'm not sure what the future is going to hold, but I'm really enjoying the role that I have now, and it's going to continue for a while, and then we'll see what happens.
You know, if I'm an NHL player and I want a future pension, how many games or how many years do I have to play in the NHL in order to make sure that I've got some sort of pension when I retire?
Well, to be fully vested, you have to play 400 games. And that number moves sometimes to 250, depending on different circumstances. But the demarcation line is right around 400 games. And the pension has evolved over time to reflect different sort of critical points in a player's career. It used to be that, you know, you had to play those 400 games, and then it got shifted to 250, and there were different circumstances that came through negotiated CBAs and other factors. So you have to play a significant amount of time to be eligible for a full pension in the National Hockey League, that's for sure. But you know, it's like most workplaces, that's what you have to do. And as you know, I mean, you work 30 years in a job, in any job, and you're vested in the pension, your benefits continue to improve. So it's very similar.
You know, you've got quite a history from player to, you know, GM to NHL Players Association. There's got to be a good story. You know, from being on the road, there's the characters that you run into in the NHL or even in the junior leagues, you know, the hazing or, you know, just the prank that you pulled with a fellow agent or something. Any story that you can share with our listeners about, you know, things that you have run into?
Again, you need a couple weeks for those. I was either the beneficiary or the not beneficiary of seeing a lot of different things over a long period of time. And, I would be hard pressed to put one ahead of the others, but I will say this, you know, in my experience in the NHL, which is basically almost everything, I think I've seen pretty well everything you could see in the business. You know, professional hockey players are truly, for the most part, just great people who contribute to their communities and are socially aware and conscious. And at times, you know, that portrayal isn't quite accurate, and it bugs the hell out of me because, you know, even though guys that I played against and we had fights, you know, and they're really good people, and they're just hard-nosed competitors that are trying to do their best for themselves and their team. And I would take big issue with anybody who disagreed with that. I think hockey players are fabulous people that contribute back in so many meaningful ways, and hopefully that'll continue.
You know, I've got one last question for you, and that is if I'm a young NHL player or I'm just about to come into the NHL player or into the NHL, what do I want to look for in a player agent? And what do I want to look for in an advisor?
Well, I think in a player agent, you definitely want someone who understands the game and the nuances of the game, who can help you in developing your playing career. And, you know, advise you about what players to look to in terms of how they live, how they train, how they operate, the dignity and character that they have, and pushing players towards that, you know, really high standard around everything they do, because I think that'll then be reflected on the ice. And I think an agent really needs to know the game well enough to not just do contracts, but also assist in player development. From a financial perspective, I mean, clearly you need someone who is completely honest, who is going to tell you good news with bad news, is going to create a really strong plan that's built around the reality of being a professional hockey player, which is, you know, you can have a very short career. And like me, I got hurt. I had suffered three major injuries in a fairly short period of time and was fortunate enough to go back and go to law school. There are lots of guys who didn't have that opportunity. And a good financial advisor is going to create a plan that has proper insurance considerations, the proper lifestyle considerations, proper controls over investment strategy, and be a fiduciary. And, you know, it's imperative that you plan for the worst case scenario in your playing career, because it often happens. Like, even though it's 400 games to get to a full pension, there's lots of players who don't play 400 games. And, you know, I would be very conscious about the integrity and the willingness to be a really solid planner in looking for a financial advisor.
Very good advice. Very good advice. You know, Mike, this has been an absolute pleasure. A lot of insight, and I appreciate your honesty about your playing days and the ups and downs that you've gone through in your playing career and subsequent after that. And GM, Vancouver lost a good GM, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And, I know you said you're not looking forward or not at this time, not considering the NHLPA, but I think that would be on the horizon as far as a good spot for you based on what you've talked about with us today.
Well, I want to throw this out.
You know, it's, like I said, we'll see how things turn out over the next little bit. And, I think the NHLPA is really uniquely positioned to do some, they do great things. I think they're really uniquely positioned to continue and build on those great things. So far it's been a lot of fun.
I got to say, I'm sorry that your career did not end up being what I think it could have been based on the skills that you had and some unfortunate injuries that you had. But I feel really good about the position you're in with the players. You saying that the players are number one, that's got to be the case. And I think they're in good hands having you in that NHLPA position.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, please don't go away. We still have our medical minute. Let's welcome back Dr. Randy Kane, chiropractor from Eau Claire. Thanks for being back as one of our featured guests for the medical minute.
Thanks for having me, guys. Today, what I'm going to be talking about is cervical acceleration, deceleration injuries, better known as whiplash, specifically after concussion. Now, generally, what will happen is an athlete who does have a concussion is going to be having some headaches, some wooziness, just some general sense of not very well-being for, usually a week to maybe even 2 weeks after that concussion. But oftentimes, because a concussion and whiplash actually have the same mechanism of injury, they will still have persistent neck pain once those headaches and those concussion symptoms have subsided. So generally what we will do with that individual is take them through an evaluation, see exactly what ligaments, because there's usually some joint capsule ligaments that have been torn and some other ligaments in the spine that have been injured. And we will start to treat them with therapy, exercise, some manual therapy, and try to get that athlete back into playing usually within 1 to 2 weeks after that injury and after they have fully recovered from that concussion.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again, Dr. Kane. And again, a huge thank you to our audience. And we'd like to again thank our featured guest, Mike Gillis. A special thank you to our sponsors, Raleigh's Coach Club and Hertel Law. Please follow us on Instagram and Twitter and visit us on our website at thebreakoutsessions.com. And folks, until our next episode, stay on your inside edges.